The Pac-12 has officially canceled all sports until May 31st. We all knew that this was going to happen. No spring games. That's what that means. The Scheme is finally coming out on HBO, where the FBI was talking about looking into the college basketball pay-for-play scandal, which we have so many thoughts about. And we have an interview with the director, Pat Condalis. We have him. Remy Martin, he turns pro, and Washington loses a legend. And finally, the NCAA does the right thing. I mean, sort of, but they can still get it wrong. I'm George Reister with Ralph Amsden, and this is the Pac-12 Apostles. Thank you guys for listening to the Pac-12 Apostles. We appreciate your time, appreciate your energy. Thank you for listening. Please make sure that you share the feed, tell a friend about the Pac-12 Apostles. And if you want to contact us, you can hit us up on Twitter at Ralph Amsden or at George Reister or at Pac-12 Apostles. Or you can send us an email. I'm mad, I-M-M-A-D, at unafraidshow.com. Ralph, the NCAA finally did the right thing. They granted seniors who played spring sports like baseball, lacrosse, softball, track and field, an extra year of eligibility for next year. And this was the right thing to do. However, the devil's always in the details. So the schools don't have to offer the same amount of aid to the kids as last year. It's up to each individual school. So that brings up scholarship counts and how they're going to handle that. So the NCAA did the right thing, but they can still screw it up. Where do you stand on this, Ralph?
They passed the buck. They passed the buck to the schools, and so the schools can be the bad guy when they never hesitate to do so. When they come in and say, hey, you know, we were paying a third of your tuition. If you want to stay now, it's going to be an eighth, because we got to open that up for an incoming freshman. You know, they could have bumped the allotted amount that every team was allowed to do. But they didn't, you know, and they put it back in the hands of schools. And some schools will do things the right way, and I think they deserve praise for that. And some schools will treat this very much like a business, the way that they always have, and won't think twice about it. And I think that, you know, media entities out there covering some of these things, if the players are brave enough to speak up and speak out on some of these things, then I think the program should have to answer some questions about their thinking and what they're doing, because a lot of these, not all of them, but a lot of them are public institutions, and the stuff that they're tossing around, you know, is mixed in with some taxpayer money, and you know, schools are still subjected to FOIA requests and things like that, and they should be as forthcoming as possible about some of the stuff that they're doing and why. Hopefully we can just, you know, rely on the humanity of some of the folks involved here. And, you know, they go about doing the right thing. But I will say that if someone just is in a Matt Leinart situation where they just have ballroom dancing, then maybe they don't need a full ride. So hopefully people's needs are being met, because that's really what this is about. If you're going to go this far out onto a limb for people, you should make sure that you go out on that limb to make sure their needs are met. You don't go out on that limb for the good publicity that's involved with it, because hopefully there will be no good publicity if this just ends up being another instance of this is a business except for the people who are on the business end type deal.
Oh yeah. Yeah. They can 100% screw this up by messing up scholarship counts. And then schools who don't, if there's a player who's not, you know, in favor or in good graces with the coaches or administration, even though that they may be eligible, if they've already graduated, they may say, yeah, you can come back and play, but you got to pay your own way. I mean, it can get real tricky. And so the NCAA did pass the buck. And now we're going to see what they say about scholarship counts. But they will not be granting extra eligibility on winter sports, which I really don't see a problem with, only because basketball was done for some teams already. Yes, there were teams that were going to the tournament for those 68 teams, and the same with the women. And you had some other winter sports who were going, like hockey, who were going to the playoffs. But, you know, like they played the whole entire season. It's almost like your team just didn't make the tournament. And it sucks. Granted, it sucks because I wanted to see Sabrina Ionescu. It felt right that she would win a championship. Like this year's just sucked because ever since Kobe died, like things, I was like, okay, the Lakers have to win a championship. Ducks have to win a championship. Sabrina, like, all this stuff is adding up. And now we may not have a whole season, dude. This is incredible.
Yeah, and you know, you invoke the name of Kobe Bryant and all this, and you know, the way that he was living his next chapter, I think it can still serve as motivation for how people are living their lives without sports, right? And I know that you and I are both trying to use this time to our advantage to get closer with our families. Not that we weren't before, but I mean, they are physically closer, and so you know, you might as well gauge what's going on with them and check in with them and spend as much quality time as them with them as you can. And that's where my focus is right now. You know, outside of this podcast, and this is a show I'm super excited for, especially after watching the Scheme is such a good movie. But I will say that most of my energy has just been focused inward because there's not a lot out there that you can control. Today, the Arizona governor shut down schools for the rest of the school year. So my kids are out for the next 4 months, you know, and I'm thinking about a lot of the class of 2020. You know, all these kids are not going to have prom. They're not going to have a graduation. You know, they're not going to have their spring sports. And I think it definitely matters more for some of these high school kids that are never going to go on to play college. They don't get any extra eligibility or anything like that. And it makes for a really interesting generation. And then also, I've been a teacher, man, and that's a not a very glamorous gig. And the best part about it is seeing other people's kids show up in front of you every single day and being able to navigate their life situations and help out any way you can while also imparting some knowledge to them that will maybe be beneficial in the future. Now all these teachers have to do that job without the only good part of it, which is hanging out with kids. And so, you know, I'm definitely feeling for a lot of people today, but it's going to continue to be like this. It's going to continue to be tight, and everyone just got to pull together. And hopefully, you know, we can do our little part with this show and entertaining some people and taking their minds off it. I know talking about it isn't the best way of getting people's minds off of it, but I mean, you know, some things you got to work through instead of avoid.
Well, here's one thing the Pac-12 did that I didn't like with the where it shut down all the activities. So it also said that their schools can't have any type of organized team activities of any type. That means that it won't allow in-person meetings, which, okay, that makes sense. And it says that virtual workouts supervised by a coach are not permitted either. Like, how are you supposed to keep these dudes in shape to make it to if football is going to be around? And then you said, and then you had UCLA canceled their spring game. Everybody else already knows that it's not happening. Kirk Herbstreit just a few days ago said he'd be shocked if there was a season next year. Said he'll be so surprised if it happens. He said, I don't know how you let these guys go into locker rooms and let stadiums be filled up and how you can play ball. I just don't know how you can do it with the optics of it. I just think that it is pretty much impossible. I mean, well, right now it feels impossible. Granted, there's a lot that can happen in between now and then. Like the NBA is looking for options where they may like put teams, whole teams in hotels, test them every day, play their season out in quarantine, basically, where everybody's in the same place, getting tested every day, everybody's quarantined. And the way you can keep anybody, if they get sick, meals are delivered, everything. So I think that that's definitely an option. But yeah, it's I don't know what the hell is going on, but I would agree with you. I am enjoying this time with my family, and I kind of feel guilty about being, you know, happy go lucky and super excited about this time on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. Like I was talking to somebody today, and I was like, you know, I'm kind of enjoying I'm very sad and scared and worried for a lot of people, but I just, man, I enjoy my family and I like having them around. And I don't, I'm, you know, I don't feel guilty about that, but I do, you know, I know that I'm enjoying it while some other people are definitely out there suffering and struggling with some major anxiety. And, you know, I feel for those people. I absolutely do. And that could easily be us, you know, a couple of days from now. But I, as far as it goes right now, you know, I think the best thing that you can do is realize that if you have things in your life that can be taken away, then you have to make sure your identity is not in those things. You know, I left my, if you Google Mercedes and Dr. Pepper, a news story comes up where my car was stolen because I left my keys in it and went inside a Circle K to get a Dr. Pepper. And the guy that took my car ended up in a shootout with the police. And it was like a huge, major, weird story. But you know, I lost everything. My camera equipment, everything that I used to do my job, all of it was in my car. And also, yeah, my car was kind of important too. And it was just right in that moment. It was like, okay, well, all my stuff is gone. My ability to do my job is gone, but my identity was not in those things. And so, you know, I got robbed, but I didn't get robbed. Like nothing was missing from who I am. And in this moment, that's what I'm trying to remind people of is like, hey, you know, there's some things that might get taken away from you in this process, but your job's not in your identity. Your job's not in your school. Your job's not in your sports team. Or your, not your job, but your identity is not in any of those things. Your identity is in, you know, your relationships and in your health. And so, you know, work on your health, whether that's mental or physical or spiritual or whatever, and work on your relationships because that's who you are. And you don't need things. You know, I did a puzzle for the first time in 20 years. And I hope to not do another one for 20 years, but I did it
for sure.
Yeah, I did it with my family and it was a good time. I mean, it was that there was no difference in the joy that I experienced doing that puzzle with my family than the times that I've spent at Disneyland with them, you know?
Yeah. That has been amazing to see as well. Like just the fact that you can, that we thought we had to go on vacation to have all these experiences, but we're actually being able to have them home and disconnect at home. Like that's dope.
And it is privilege, like, right. Like we have the privilege of having, you know, there's some people that are alone right now and they're probably pretty anxious and scared. And I definitely feel for those people, but I have enjoyed the time with my family. It's been cool. You and I check in every couple of days to make sure like the mental health is all there and everything. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And so you have no choice but to cling to those things that matter.
Yep, 100%. And one of the things that matters, everybody knows I'm an Oregon guy, but we do like to pay homage to, like, at the end of the day, this is just sports. And yes, it affects people's lives, but the humans are more important. So we want to give a shout out to former Pac-12 coach who passed away. His name is Jim Lambright. He was a dirty, rotten scoundrel of a Husky. But he was an assistant there from 1969 to 1977. He's beloved around the program. He was the defensive coordinator from 78 to 92, and then the head coach from 93 to 98. So he had a 636 coaching record. He got there. His last year was the year that I showed up at, was the year before I showed up at Oregon. So, yeah, dude, he was with them during their sort of national championship. He was there with them through the good times. So we want to honor him in that.
He's a man of just a completely different era. You know, we talk about, you know, I know Todd Graham got in trouble for calling assistant coaches mercenaries, but that's essentially what they are. You know, there's so much money in this right now that everybody is very focused on what they can do for themselves and how they can better their situation right now. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. Not at all. I'm not criticizing that, but there is something just sort of romantic about that era when you could spend what was essentially a lifetime with one team. And he was on the sidelines coaching for the University of Washington for 30 consecutive seasons. And that's after he played defensive end there from 1962 to 1964. And he grew up in Everett, Washington. Like, that's not that far away from Seattle, right? So, like, I think it's a suburb, if I'm not mistaken. And so, you know, he came up in Washington. He played for Washington. He coached high school ball in Washington. And then he coached at University of Washington for 30 seasons. It doesn't get much more Husky purple than that. And, you know, I know some people in that community are hurting right now. And how weird is it that we're in a situation where it's going to be frowned upon for people to go out and just pay their respects, you know? So it's definitely a weird time, and I don't want it to be overshadowed that he's an enormous part of University of Washington's identity and a huge part of their history. And yeah, he'll be missed.
Yep. Schools are also, I've noticed a trend, to move on to the next subject. I've noticed a trend with, college basketball players this year. It seems like there are more players declaring for the draft in light of this Corona situation. I'm wondering if it's going to have an impact, because truthfully, there's only 60 people drafted in the NBA every year. 60.
Yeah.
Two rounds. And we've seen Oregon players continuously come out inexplicably and go in the second round or go undrafted. And like good players, like guys who would have been first round draft picks the next year. And yes, the kid in Tyler Dorsey's had a little bit of success. The kid in Memphis, the kid from Canada. Anyways, so some of them have had success, but it's always frustrating to me when you see guys come out early and you're just like, oh no, like the Moses kid from UCLA last year. He's like, what are you doing? You couldn't even dominate in college. Like, what are we doing here? But colleges are also having to deal with people leaving and then their seniors not having the exit that they thought they would have, like Oregon with Peyton Pritchard. And now at Arizona State, we find out that they're going to lose Remy Martin to the NBA draft. What's your take on that, Ralph? Because I know that you cover him and see them a lot.
Yeah, I mean, this is 2 years in a row that Arizona State fans are kind of floored by the early exit of one of their players. Last year, Lou Dort had a couple of people, I think, project him as a late first-round pick, and he ended up going undrafted. And then you had a lot of people come out of the woodworks to say, I told you so. Meanwhile, he found a way to, despite being undrafted, start 21 games this year for the Thunder. So he ended up getting it figured out, and he's in that situation where he's not locked into a 5-year deal because of it. Yeah. So, you know, if he continues playing the way that he's playing defensively on an NBA roster, assuming the NBA continues to be a thing, you know, then, you know, he'll definitely be able to cash in. So you never know if it's the decision of a teammate or what. You know, Remy Martin's an interesting guy because he's got a huge following. Filipino basketball fans are some of the most like dedicated and fanatic people out there. And I think that's, you know, with that being part of his heritage, he's got a really, really big following out there. And he's somebody who kind of just quietly goes about his business. He's not super interested in social media. He loves to find ways to give back. I think he's done a lot to send shoes to the Philippines. There's a bunch of different articles out there about the different types of NCAA allowable philanthropy that he was involved with before coming to ASU and since. And I think that, you know, he would have been a favorite to possibly win Pac-12 Player of the Year next year. And so there's a little bit of surprise there. But at the same time, you know, I think there's a lot of people out there that don't think he's ready for the NBA. I don't think it matters. He's a dog. He's an effort guy. He's a lot of fun to watch. And I think that he'll be a fan favorite no matter where he ends up. And I think he's got the kind of personality where he'd be okay playing internationally. And just giving it his all for wherever he goes and using it to build his life experience and life's adventures and everything like that. He's just that kind of guy. And so, you know, I know that there are some rules in place right now that allow for players to test the waters and come back. So there's a sliver of hope for ASU fans that Remy Martin returns.
But you can't put the post out like that if you're testing the water. I think that's a pretty definitive post. Like when you post the, all right, I'm out, guys. And then sometimes it takes too much humble pie for guys to eat to come back, which I think is the thing that you have to be willing to do is say, all right, look, this ain't the best move for me. I put my name out there. I'm coming back. That, and it's no shame, but I think sometimes people let that shame lay on them and wear on them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and ASU fans, you know, they didn't handle this news very well. Not only do they not think he's ready, they're worried that that Bobby Hurley could take an opportunity elsewhere without his point guard. Meanwhile, I'm back here like, okay, so here we go. We're going to play Alonzo Verge 40 minutes a game and see what that dude can do. Because he to me...
He's number two, right?
Yeah, he's the guy with the ridiculous crossover off the bench. So I put him in, play him 40 minutes, let him run the point. He can do it.
He's built like Jim Jackson. Like he's strong, physical. I like him, dude. He looks like an NBA guy to me.
And so I say run it through him, and I think that you'll be able to salvage some stuff. And they got Eddie House's kid backing him up. They could play a little bit of defense and gives you some energy off the bench. I think they'll be fine. I think every college basketball fan is devastated year over year through the players that leave early. I know you as somebody who follows Oregon, and I think we even talked about this on one of our first podcasts. So just some of the people leaving Oregon, you know, that maybe shouldn't have. But I think that every fan outside of being a Kentucky fan gets sick of it because they want those players to stick around as long as possible, especially if they're not a one and done. I think that's the thing that kind of took some of the ASU fans by surprise. And they're thinking back on, you know, a lot of players leaving after 3 years and not necessarily being ready for the NBA, whether that's Ike Diagu or Jahi Carson. But it worked out for Lou Dort and it worked for James Harden. And so, you know, when you feel like you're ready, you got to go ahead and take that chance.
Yeah. And I get it. Cause I was a kid who left school early. So I get it, but you also have to, you know, make sure that you're putting yourself in the best possible situation.
Yeah.
And you don't know, but you do have to take the advice of people who are in the know, because it's a big difference in being in basketball, a second round draft pick than a first round draft pick. You don't have a guaranteed contract. It's just like if you're going to be in the NFL draft and you're not coming out, you're not going to be if you're a kid who's coming out as a junior and you have no possibility of being a first round draft pick, and you're maybe a second round, you're probably a third round, then you should stay in school because you could be a first round draft pick. Yeah. But because there's so much money at stake, and then there's the opportunity, because first round draft picks stay in the league on average way longer because the teams have so much money and hope wrapped up into them that you get more opportunities. So like, you don't want to be a seventh round draft pick because that rope is short, buddy. You are one pulled hamstring away from getting cut.
Yeah. And Remy, I just see him as somebody who, if he doesn't get drafted and he doesn't, you know, I think he'll have, yeah. And I think he'll be fine. I don't think it matters for him ultimately where he plays basketball, as long as he's being given the opportunity to earn a living. Cause he's one of those, like, you're blessed to bless others. Right. So he's one of those people that's going to use whatever means and resources that he gets to immediately turn around and invest in other people. My hope is that that comes with $100 million NBA contract someday, but it, you know, in all likelihood, it probably won't. That only happens for a few people here and there. And so, you know, I think that he's going to be somebody he's just going to land on his feet. And so maybe that's it. Maybe it's that he feels done with college, like just as a person, because he came in more mature than everybody else around him. And, you know, 4 years in school for a point guard, usually that fourth year, that's when they go off, right? That's that Steve Nash year. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you won't find a way to go out there and get an opportunity It's just, you know, it's tough because there's already people out there tweeting that he's not a top 60 player. And everybody, that's really a decision that everybody has to weigh themselves. And I don't blame him, but I do get some of the sadness and frustration of ASU fans because that was their, you know, that was their favorite guy.
Yeah, but that's also living from a fandom place of lack. When you're like, our best player's leaving, that means you don't feel very confident in what is left in the cupboard behind him. But Ralph, it is time. I know you've been waiting. I know you've been just stewing on this all day. So I was able to get us advanced screening for the Scheme on HBO. The Scheme on HBO is a documentary about Christian Dawkins, the guy who was at the center of the FBI probe into the underbelly of college basketball. It was supposed to, the New York Southern District said they were going to blow the lid off it, that they had the playbook, that they were going to indict all these coaches. Everything was coming down because this pay-for-play scandal was defrauding schools. There were so many victims in this. Christian Dawkins was just a user and abuser of these high school players. And then we see the documentary and we saw no college coaches get fired besides Rick Pitino. And that was questionable. We saw, we only heard Sean Miller and the LSU Will coach,
Wade.
Will Wade on tape. Nothing came of it. Nothing. Like, they weren't allowed to be subpoenaed, anything. And you actually had millions of dollars trade hands. You had FBI man hours, all of this stuff to give 6 and 9 month prison sentences for a victimless crime.
So let's first of all, let's just address the elephant in the room right off the bat, because listeners to this podcast are going to want to know what we think of, you know, John Wilner. He was somebody who also had an advanced screening of this, and he basically just came out and said he doesn't see Sean Miller ever coaching another game for University of Arizona. And that's got University of Arizona fans who don't even like Sean Miller. That's got them all up in arms because they want to believe that this entire investigation from the get-go, especially some of the media coverage of it, has just been a giant sham. So even though they would be fine with Sean Miller moving on, they don't want it to be for this reason, because they don't want to be wrong and without a coach, right?
How, like, do you fire Sean Miller? I have been on the Sean Miller is overrated train and is not getting the results.
But I'm with you.
How do you fire him when Will Wade isn't fired, when there are other coaches on tape that haven't come out that they've suppressed? Nobody's getting in trouble for this except for low-level people, and it's over. It is literally over. Like, nobody else is getting fired. There's no smoking gun coming out because everything is suppressed. Somebody stop this.
I do not. I 100% do not see Sean Miller getting fired after watching this. Could there be a mutual parting of ways just over the frustration of, you know, the building frustration of the fan base in Tucson and the fact that they keep underachieving with absolute mega levels of talent, and the fact that his 10-year assistant did, you know, jail time, and maybe he just needs a reset. I think his son. His youngest son is set to graduate from high school in Tucson this year. So, you know, some of his ties to the area are going to lessen. I could see them coming together and having a mutual parting of ways, but there's no way I see University of Arizona coming out and saying, based on the fact that it's pretty obvious that Sean Miller lied about his level of contact and his relationship with Christian Dawkins when he was addressing the media and not being forthcoming, and the fact that he talks like he looks like a prohibition gangster, and he talks like one too. I don't think those will be reasons to dump him, especially if LSU's not going to do anything with Will Wade. Because if anybody's guilty, it's
that boy, dirtiest. Oh man! Oh my Lord! But we have a treat for you guys. We have a treat for you guys. Before we get into all the discussion about it, I was able to interview Pat Condalis earlier. He's the director who directed the film, and you guys can hear what he had to say. He had a lot because there's so much stuff that was left on the cutting room floor, and he was able to talk about that. So listen in to him, and then we'll come back and we will discuss all of it. First, Pat, thanks for joining us today. Thanks for taking time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Is the family safe, healthy, whole, everything during this corona scare?
We're all going a little insane, but, you know, health and safety-wise, we're all good, so no complaints.
Yeah, so I got a chance to watch the entire scheme. And as a person who is connected to the Pac-12, connected to the media, I've heard all sorts of things, and it looked very damning from the beginning once you heard the Arizona coach, Coach Miller, and you heard the LSU coach on tape. And I thought that this was going to be a huge, huge thing. And it turned out to be just a few minor level people that ended up going to jail. What was your takeaway overall from the whole process of doing this film?
Well, it was such an unbelievable story. And to your point, like you said in the intro, you know, I heard about this like everybody else did when the press conference was announced by the Southern District in New York saying, look, this is a 3-year undercover FBI investigation. There was wiretaps. They arrested an executive for Adidas. So you got billion-dollar global, you know, shoe companies involved in this. So I remember, you know, talking with my editor actually about that story right when it broke, thinking, okay, this is going to change the landscape of college athletics. I mean, they're going to take down big name coaches, you know, Pitino's name was thrown out there right from the get-go, and then just nothing happened.
Yep.
And so the story just kind of went away. And I was not really familiar with Christian until HBO, you know, kind of brought this to me and said, hey, would you be interested in doing something like this? And then I read, I think, about every article that had been written about Christian. And him and I got on the phone, and then I flew out to where he was and spent 3 days with him just talking. And I found him to be such a fascinating, dynamic, complex, intelligent, hilarious individual. And there was clearly so much more to the story that I was like, you know, I really, really have to tell this story. And, you know, it was a roller coaster ride making this, because we started making it in between the first and second federal trial. So all of this stuff was unfolding while we were shooting. And the story kept evolving as new information came out, new evidence came to light. And from my perspective, this was just a much, much bigger story than just a sports story and just a Christian Dawkins story.
Yeah, so Christians specifically, who does a lot of the narration, how credible, how believable was he, and how forthcoming did you feel like he was in the production process?
I found him to be very credible, and the reason I say that is, you know, we have the FBI wiretaps.
Yep.
So we could corroborate almost everything that he said in the interview. Because we could listen to him in real time, not knowing that he's being recorded. So you can hear, and that's the interesting thing about this is rarely do you get a chance to tell a story and put the audience in the room on the phone, pull back the curtain, right? This is kind of a fly on the wall experience for the audience, where you get to hear the kind of unvarnished, the raw truth of what's happening here, because none of these people know they're being recorded, whether it's the wiretap calls or the undercover FBI video where you watch some things happen. They don't know they're being recorded. So you get to hear the thought process and you get to hear what he's saying. So when Christian answers a question in the interview with me, the vast majority of that, 90 to 95% of it, I would say we could corroborate with evidence that was gathered for this whole investigation. So I found Christian to be incredibly credible. But he did stop short on a few different topics. He was not the most forthcoming on a couple of things. And the biggest disagreement him and I,
what are those topics?
I think the biggest, Yeah, the biggest disagreement him and I had was regarding Rick Pitino, because I just cannot believe that Rick Pitino did not know what was going on. I refuse to believe that.
Well, so so my question about that is that do you think that that fell in line with the fact that he would not rat out any coaches? I mean, he was pretty adamant that he wasn't, that he was going to stand up and not try to tear down everybody in their career.
Yeah, exactly. That was the thing. Yeah, he didn't want to be a rat. And I think he avoided that as much as possible. And I think his position, he became more and more eager, I think, to have his perspective included and to be more, I think less guarded about everything as the situation evolved and the fluidity of the trial. And yeah, I think by the end of it, when he's the guy that goes down and gets an 18-month prison sentence, you know, longer than anybody else, I think all of that kind of changed his perspective a little bit. And he was more willing to be a little bit more open with some of that stuff where he wasn't before, just as a point to say, listen, like, I'm the fall guy here, but this is not an accurate depiction of what was going on.
Oh, that's exactly.
I was going to say, but Christian was defiant in saying that Pitino didn't know anything and that he did not believe that Pitino had direct knowledge. And I will say, I mean, we couldn't find any evidence that said that Pitino did have direct knowledge. The feds didn't have it, obviously. And he was never even, I think, gotten close to being charged unless Christian would have decided to give them information. And I think Christian has that information. I think he just wasn't willing to share it.
But why? Like, there was no advantage for him sharing it aside from, you know, yes, he could have got off some more time, but he seems like a guy who's about helping players and doing and really taking advantage of a capitalistic system that seems broken when it comes to college athletics. But the question for you is, Pat, who is the bad guy here? Like who is the bad guy in this situation? Because it doesn't seem like it's Christian Dawkins.
I agree with you, and I think that's a great question. I think that's a question that we wanted the audience to ask themselves that when they watched the documentary. The other question we wanted them to ask is who's the victim here? Right? For a crime to be committed, by definition, there's got to be a victim.
Yes.
And so when the Southern District proposed that it was these universities were victimized by this, it was such a laughable, absurd proposition for people to accept. And it was really interesting to sit there. And I went to the sentencing of the first federal trial, and then every day for the second trial, I was there. And it was this weird, like, unspoken arrangement between everybody that walked from the hallway into the courtroom, that it was like, okay, everybody's going to pretend like reality is doesn't exist. Right. And we're going to act like we're all living in an alternate universe within this courtroom here, you know, because it was unbelievable the narrative that was being pitched to a jury and judges, and the fact that people weren't kind of laughing out loud in the courtroom was shocking to me.
Yeah, it's a victimless crime. So if Christian Dawkins actually paid the players, okay, who is harmed in that? And then the colleges, they get the players and they go to win games. Who is the, I can't still figure out, as a former college athlete, former professional athlete, as a thinker, a person who reads books, I cannot figure out who is harmed by this.
Right. And what the narrative that the Southern District of New York came up with was that the universities were the victims. They were harmed by this because these athletes were no longer eligible for amateur status if they had been given money or any sort of inducements, right? So by the time they went in there, then they considered that fraud. So they're defrauding the university. You're defrauding them out of the value of the scholarship, right? Mm-hmm. It's an unbelievably insane...
You could just give it to somebody else.
You could give it to somebody else. But then that leads to a million different questions, right? So that if I think what Dan Wetzel says, his example in the doc is I think perfect, where, you know, so the top quarterback, right, of the team, he goes into the pizza shop and he gets a free slice of pizza. You've just made him ineligible under NCAA rules, right? So have you then just defrauded a massive university? And under the Southern District's definition, you committed multiple federal felonies.
Yeah.
And that's what this precedent is saying.
Well, that's where I hate the way the NCAA is set up, which you kind of blew the lid off with this, with the scheme, is that Dan Wetzel actually reiterated it too, which he said, if Google or Amazon came into a high school and said, we're going to pay interns $20,000 to come out, teach them in hopes that they'll come to come work for them later, that there would be nothing illegal with that. They would actually applaud that. But then when it comes to college basketball, and this is where the race factor comes in, because Christian brought it up too.
Yeah.
If these weren't mainly young urban black kids, would this even be an issue?
Right. Right. Yeah. His point is, I think he makes a very strong point in that, look, if the whole system with the NCAA in general, and using basketball as an example, if all the players were white, and all the head coaches that are making millions of dollars a year and the ADs and you know, everybody running the schools and the institutions were all black, his point was there's no way that this would be happening.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be happening. Nobody would tolerate that billions of dollars are being made every year and none of that money is going to the players.
It's a very, very interesting, compelling point. Yeah. Yeah, and it's a point that people don't really necessarily want to recognize, because it might cause them to be honest about some uncomfortable truths. But a guy that was talked about a lot in the scheme, which is actually released Tuesday at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern time on HBO, was Marty Blazer, and I met Marty Blazer because.
Did you really?
Yes, because he. So I played. I came out and was drafted with a guy named Rasheen Mathis, and
okay.
And Marty Blazer was Rasheen Mathis's financial advisor, and Marty lived in Atlanta, I believe, and And so Rasheen used to always say, yeah, dude, Marty's doing all these great things, blah, blah, blah. And then I met him a couple of times. I thought about moving my money over there, where in the doc, it didn't necessarily show that Marty was really big in the football world. Like, he had a lot of NFL clients. And so those were the people that he mainly defrauded. And just the fact that he stole all these millions and then – like, this is how this whole investigation started, was Marty trying to get out of jail. And ultimately, he got out of jail for sending Christian Dawkins and some low-level people to jail. Like, it just didn't make sense to me.
Concocting a ridiculous scenario that really these guys, you know, discuss on wiretaps time and time again. Again, not knowing that they're being recorded, that they don't want to do.
Yep.
But the whole business model that was kind of created by the FBI, that was initiated by Marty Blazer, was ridiculous. And it makes sense because, you know, I listened to Marty Blazer testify. I think he testified for 5 days in the second trial. And sitting there, it was very, very clear he knew nothing about how the basketball world worked.
Yeah,
nothing
clear.
It felt the
wiretaps, listening to the wiretaps, I thought you did a great job displaying like what people knew and how many times Christian Dawkins tried to tell them, I don't want to do this. This is not the way it works. And it almost felt like entrapment, because they tried to get something that he wasn't even willing to do.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it was, you know, that was a big question I had early on looking at everything. And Christian's lawyer, I think, came up with the best explanation of it, was that it's you can't call it entrapment, because the point is they would say that this is something that you would have to prove that this was behavior that he had not otherwise been likely to participate in, right? And because Christian had paid people before, they couldn't necessarily make that argument. But I mean, I would assume that any objective person watching it would say this is as close to coming to entrapment as you could possibly get.
Yeah, I totally agree. I want to talk real quick about the two college coaches that were, three. We already covered Rick Pitino, who ultimately ended up getting fired. But Sean Miller at Arizona and Will Wade at LSU, who are clearly on wiretaps talking about this. But other coaches were on wiretaps too. But why do you think that the federal government kept, kept saying no to the subpoenas for the wiretaps in the trials? Why do you think that the government wanted this hush kibosh so badly?
That's the biggest question of this entire thing for me. When we started digging in and we got all of the evidence that was collected and that was presented in discovery publicly in these trials, that we could break it down and listen to all of that and look at it, it was very, very clear, putting everything together, was like, wait a second, what? This changed, right? The trajectory of this entire investigation from the very beginning was taking down major D1 coaches, potential Hall of Fame coaches. That was the whole point. That's why they spent 3 years and millions of dollars of taxpayers' money to do this. They were going to take down huge name coaches. And then not only did they not do that, but at a certain point in the investigation, they do a 180. And they go away from their intended objective of taking them down to protecting them, ultimately. So we knew that there was wiretaps of multiple coaches. And there's three that we put into the doc that are, from my understanding, is they're technically under seal. They've never been played in a courtroom publicly. They've never been played anywhere publicly as far as I know. And we had multiple sources that gave us those. I've been told there's a lot more with those coaches and with other coaches. I haven't been able to corroborate the number and exactly what is being said on them. But the reason that I wanted those calls in there was not to necessarily be salacious regarding those coaches, but it was to show they had evidence, and I think objectively strong evidence, against these coaches. And not only did they not charge them, but they protected them. They denied those being played publicly. They blocked subpoenas to get these coaches to come into the courtroom and testify. And I mean, what was going to happen if they walked in and testified? It wasn't going to be Christian Dawkins' attorneys trying to get these coaches in trouble. They were going to ask them, hey, did Christian Dawkins ever bribe you? Right? Like, that was going to be the whole point. But the fact that they wouldn't even let them step foot in the courtroom after 3 years of trying to put them in the courtroom and put them in jail, didn't make any sense to me. And I still don't know why that was the case, but that became the biggest, most intriguing question, I think, in this entire thing. Why did this change?
That was a decree from on high. I wonder though, like, how much that this name, image, and likeness, because this, what Christian Dawkins was doing, paying the players or using his influence to help them go to certain schools, then sign them later with the agent Andy Miller and, other situations. I just looked at the tie-in with the name, image, and likeness legislation, which that would clearly fall under. And I'm just wondering, what do you think about the name, image, likeness legislation as it relates to these trials where the subpoenas for the coaches weren't allowed? Like, do you think that any of this is tied in behind the scenes?
I don't know if it is. I mean, somebody stopped it. There's no two ways about that. Somebody stopped it and completely shifted the direction of the investigation and the direction of the prosecution, clearly, very, very clearly. And that was, again, like, that is the point that is why we put those calls in there, is to show, look, they have evidence. They have lots of wiretaps of Christian Dawkins talking specifically about money and paying players. So it was so strange to me that changed, and then magically the calls are placed under seal. The NCAA supposedly is not allowed to get them, even though I don't believe for a second they actually wanted to hear any of that. And they certainly don't want it to come out. But clearly somebody, and Christian says in the doc, it's a cover-up, and it's hard to argue that point, because you just don't know what happened, and people are preventing that information from getting out, and they're preventing that question from really being answered in any sort of detailed way. So I just don't know why they did it, but I think that that question probably looms largest over this entire thing. There's plenty of other questions that come up in, yeah. you know, after you get the context and you can see exactly what happened and how this unfolded. I think it, we answer a lot of questions in the doc, but I think at the end of it, we probably ask a couple of really big questions that we just can't answer.
Yes. And so I have two questions about that, which is two of the questions that I were left with, which was a point that you guys made in the doc, was that where Jim Gatto and Merrill Code from Adidas both got prison, they both were charged and convicted. But I just thought, and then Adidas is in bed with Louisville, and so are these yeah. other schools that have these huge contracts, and like, and that's where I always say, who do you work for? Because
right,
does LeBron James work for the NBA or does he work for Nike?
Right,
he works for Nike.
Right, right.
And so there was one name that was not brought up in the documentary that I wondered why or why not, which is Nike. The name Nike as yeah. it related to this, because I know that in, the, I believe, the second trial, that there was some talk about it. Then you had Michael Avenatti, the lawyer, trying to extort Nike. Like, what happened with Nike? Why was it necessarily excluded from it, even excluded from the documentary as much as Adidas was, or is it just because Jim Gatto and Code got prison sentences?
It was because there was more evidence that was directly connected to Christian in those cases that we could access with Adidas. The Nike thing was, it was brought up, I think, in the second trial, just in relation to Zion Williamson and some alleged offers that, that were made for his family. But there wasn't much that came up in these first two trials regarding Nike with Christian. Now, the Avenatti thing, the crazy irony of this is, right, like, they go after Jim Gatto. They sentence him to 9 months in prison for basically giving a kid a scholarship so that he goes to a school that Adidas is already sponsoring. In any other situation, that's a great deal for everybody. But in this particular situation, the federal government thought that was a felony. But in the Avenatti case, Nike, they pretty much openly admit to all of the same things that the Southern District just went after Adidas for. So there's clearly, in my mind, like, there's selective prosecution across the board in this thing. And I mean, whether it's Nike and Adidas and one being charged and the other not being charged, or if it's, look at the way that the coaches are treated and protected, right? You have Will Wade and Sean Miller who the Southern District fights to prevent them from stepping foot into the courtroom and blocks those calls from coming out publicly, yet they destroy Christian Dawkins publicly, right? There's clearly a difference in treatment between somebody like Christian Dawkins and Sean Miller and Will Wade. You can point to race, you can point to resources, you can point to power, whatever it is. You cannot tell me with a straight face that those guys are being treated equally in the eyes of the criminal justice system.
No, I looked at this, and as a person who's around sports and has a son who's an eighth grader, know a lot of the top kids around, because my son goes to Sierra Canyon. And okay. So, and you know who's there. And so
right,
I,
right.
And being around the college, I'm sorry, the recruiting game for football, basketball, baseball, being around it, I can tell you for sure that nothing has changed. That nothing has
right.
changed. That this right. child didn't stop anything. It didn't change it. I just hope that the name, image, likeness stuff comes up by. That it comes through correctly, and that the states don't let this just pass. But Pat, I want to thank you for your time today. But I do have one more question, and it's about yeah. Christian Dawkins. And I looked at it, and this dude has done a lot. And I looked, he's 25. Yeah. He's 25 years yeah. old. He looks like the Doogie Howser of sports. He was getting,
that's a good way of putting it.
He was getting coaches to pay him $600, I think, when he was 12 years old. Like, this kid is a savant. And
he is.
And like, I'm like, he's not a criminal mastermind. He's Bill Gates. Like, he has that type of potential. That's what I thought. What was your take on him personally, his intelligence, and his future, whether it's in music, signing the deal with Atlantic Records and all of that?
Christian is a one-of-a-kind character, a very, very unique individual, a very, very intelligent individual. He is very, very mature for his age. He is unbelievably funny, self-deprecating. But I think, you know, one of the best qualities, I think, of Christian, and looking at him within this context of the sports world and the recruiting and agent world and all of that, where greed is always there, and normally people are stepping on other people's heads to get ahead themselves, we never found any evidence of Christian doing that. In fact, it was always him making a move or making a deal that benefited everybody, so everybody could win. And there was something admirable, I think, within the, again, the world of sports, that he was doing that time and time again. And you can hear him here, like, you know, my investors, they want to pay you here. I'm just trying to get some money in your pocket. You've helped me out. I'm going to help you out. You know, it was a very interesting to learn that about him, and especially at such a young age, the connections that he had forged, the relationships that he had. He's a very, very impressive individual, and I think he's going to be wildly successful in his life.
I think the question that people would have is, how in the hell was he able to forge these relationships that people pay millions and millions of dollars to get? Like, how was he able to, like, you saw in the documentary Fred Van Fleet talk about how much he trusts him. Like, guys that I've asked about, they like this dude still. They don't believe he's a crook. They don't believe he's a criminal. They think he's a good guy. Like, they would trust him to manage them now, but he's persona non grata in the basketball world.
It's funny you bring up Fred Van Vliet. Like, so Fred has his own, like, clothing line, and his slogan is "Bet on Yourself." He got that from Christian. The night of the draft, Christian was saying, "Hey, there's some offers, but they want you to go to the D League. I don't think you should do it. I think you should wait. We can do this. Bet on yourself." And like, that stuck with him to the point that that's become his own mantra. That a 22-year-old kid said to him on the phone, who was acting as his agent, even though the 22-year-old kid had never taken a license and never passed the exam to become an agent, he's the one doing all of these deals at 22.
Dude, he's like the lawyer in Suits.
he's really impressive, but I think what helps him be so successful, to your point, is that he understands how to read people. And he figures out a way very quickly so that they can benefit while he benefits as well, so that everybody wins. And that's a pretty important commodity to have in business.
Yeah, and he's involved in music now. Do you? I feel like he belongs in sports. Do you think that there's any path for him to get back into the sports world? And if so, when and how?
If there is a path, Christian will find it. if there's a way to make something happen, he will find that way, no doubt about it.
Did you guys suffer any lawsuits and like people trying to, like, what were some of the obstacles they were trying to stop you, I should say?
Not yet. I mean, the biggest thing that we had was just nobody would talk. You know, that's why we only have, I don't know, there's 6 or 7 people I think interviewed total in the doc, which is probably the smallest number of subjects that I've ever interviewed for something like this. Nobody would talk. You know, there's lots of different reasons for that, but that was surprising. I mean, it's always difficult to get people to sit down in front of a camera and give their perspective and their side of a story, especially something like this that was, you know, kind of a traumatic experience for so many people. But
it was
very, very difficult to get people to talk. Yeah.
Well, because when you do talk, you essentially exile yourself if you are snitching on other people. Like, I remember
exactly.
A number of years ago when they were talking about college, they were talking about college athletes being paid, particularly in football. I think somebody called me. It might have been an HBO Real Sports story or something. They called me and they asked me about Oregon. They were like, George, he knows where the bodies are buried, this and that.
Right.
He may have been a part of this because there were some things that happened at school that probably lended itself to that possibly being true. And I was just like, you got the wrong guy. I was like, if you're expecting to call me, who still goes up to Oregon, gets favors, is treated very well, got put in the Hall of Fame, like if you and is doing well, if you think that I'm the guy to talk to, you have found and who will take down the Oregon program, which I love right. with every ounce of my being. No, sorry. You might as well never call me again about this, because I will not be that guy. So I know nothing.
Yeah,
that were if I did know anything, which I don't.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. I mean, there was a lot of the same stuff, and I get that. You know, we didn't want to. Our point too in this, we didn't want to be trying to take down as many people as we could either. You know, because I personally think the players should be getting paid. They should be able to make money off their image and likeness, and you know, test out the free market with that. So we didn't want to, even the coaches, I'm like, you know, I don't really have a problem with what they did. My problem is that there's actually evidence that was collected in this case, and then it was basically brushed under the rug. And I think that's wildly unfair.
Yep. There is a free market for ventilators right now, but there's not a free market for college, for college basketball players. Get out of here, dude. Pat, thanks again. I appreciate it. I look forward to all the stuff that you do and put out, and we'll be following you and super excited about this.
Well, thank you so much, George. It was a pleasure talking to you. Have a good one.
Okay, you too. Okay, bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Ralph, this whole thing started because of one guy. In an unrelated case, that's Marty Blazer, the financial guy who I knew. I knew Marty Blazer because he was one of my former teammates in Jacksonville who I got drafted with, who I trained with before I drafted. He was Marty Blazer's client. Marty Blazer was not an NBA guy, really. He was more in the NFL space of managing guys' money. And he stole money to make a Ving Rhames movie that sucked. And then he was trying to use a get out of jail free card to say he knew some corruption going on in college basketball. And that's how this whole thing started, because Marty Blazer was getting ready to go to jail. So after hearing the director talk, Ralph, Pat talk, after watching the scheme, who is the bad guy?
Okay, well, first of all, Marty Blazer sucks, right? That dude is the worst. I think that Christian Dawkins probably put it best. And that dude, we'll get into Christian Dawkins and his dry sense of humor in a little bit. But Marty Blazer stole from black men and got away with it because he put other black men in jail. That was my takeaway. This guy is a cancer. He needs his ass whooped, is what he needs.
And a 20-year jail sentence.
Absolutely. And he ended up only getting probation back in February, right? So he is not going to do any jail time. And he stole millions
of dollars.
Right? And people who gave money away, ended up doing jail time. So people who gave money away did jail time, and somebody who stole millions. It does sound to me like maybe you saw that Ving Rhames movie.
No. Did you? Okay. No, I was like, when they said he funded a movie, I was like, oh, okay. Then I saw Ving Rhames. I was like, this movie's terrible.
Okay.
I was like, so I can tell from the trailer it sucks.
Here's my biggest fear, because Marty Blazer is the worst. Marty Blazer might end up making money off this documentary, because I cannot wait to go watch that movie. It looks so bad. And I'm like, man, am I putting money in Marty Blazer's pocket by seeking this out? So hopefully I can find a way to illegally download it, allegedly. But I want to see it.
I like that. I do want to see it, but I don't want to put a dollar in that crook's pocket.
You're going to have to call up some friends and be like, man, they stole your money for this.
Right? Dude. So what was your takeaway of Christian Dawkins?
I love the guy. Honestly, like he's definitely paid a heavy price for the rapidness of his ascension. But I like him. I like the man, that kid is all American, right?
Yes, he's the definition of the American dream, all American. Like, this dude is going to be, if not a billionaire, a extremely successful person. He's 25. He's 25.
He could be president. He could be president because there's no rules anymore about who can be president. So he could be president. Like, this dude is the, and he, what did he say? He's on the level of Malcolm X and Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Dick Clark. And his mom's like reading that list off and she's laughing about it. And I was like, maybe he might be.
Right.
This dude had this. Yes. I know what you're going to bring up. He had coaches paying him $600 at age 12. And then he was still doing 12-year-old stuff. Like, he ranked himself on his website as the number one player.
Dude, his mom, he had checks showing up at the house and his mom was like, "What is this for?" He was like, "Oh, that's for my business." She's like, "What business?" Dude, I wish my kid would have checks showing up. I'd be like, "Hold on, kid. Whatever you're doing, let's figure out how we can do this better. Because I'm not going to step in your way because you have clearly got something figured out. As long as it's not illegal, we're good."
Right. And in America, there's a lot of stuff that you can do to make money. And if the rules are murky, right? If the rules are murky, then you just sort of, you go through, you forge your own path, and then you end up being the one who takes the hit if people try to make new rules or something like that. I mean, this is the week where everyone in America, if they have Netflix, is binging Tiger King. Like, and we're talking about Christian Dawkins on that level of like, of just entrepreneurial spirit. But in Tiger King, people got killed, people got disappeared, you know, hitmen were hired, drugs were used. All Christian Dawkins did was try to make sure that kids were fairly compensated for their talents while using his entrepreneurial spirit to benefit himself and others in the process. Like, I if you're going to be somebody who participates that fervently in capitalism, that you're willing to step over some lines, I mean, why not be a Robin Hood in the process? And then that's how I viewed him.
Who is the victim? Like, that, oh, yeah. That's the part I could not, I still can't wrap myself around it. Who is the victim? What did Christian Dawkins do? Because if Google, Dan Wetzel said it best in the documentary, if Google or Amazon went to a high school and said, "Look, we're going to give you $20,000 to come out, be an intern in hopes that we can hire you again later after you get out of school," everybody would applaud it. And then if they did it for free, they'd be like, "Yo, that's a bad deal." But then when it comes to young black men going to college and people making billions of dollars off of their name, image, and likeness, all of a sudden it's a problem. It's a crime. Like Christian, everybody who, the Fred Van Fleet, I've talked to other NBA players. I called them today and was like, "Yo, what do you know about Christian Dawkins?" They're like, "Oh man, I like that dude. He's good. He's trustworthy, good, clean dude." Like, and I'm just sitting there like, okay, if these dudes still trust him despite everything that everybody else has said, and everybody regards him as a good human being, and that he hasn't like tried to get over on anybody, he was just trying to make sure everybody got something. Where's the victim, Ralph?
That's the amazing part. Is so, in order for the FBI to make their case, they needed someone to pin the tort on, like the harm, right? So they had to assign the harm for Adidas trying to guide an athlete to a school that they are already paying $160 million to by footing the bill for $100,000 to get that kid to that school.
The kid, Brian Bowen.
Yeah. So the FBI had to say that in the relationship of a school receiving both $160 million and a player who they paid $100,000 to in order to go to that school to enhance that school's brand, the school is ultimately the victim.
How?
And that was like
comedy.
Yeah, that's like, I mean, that's amazing to me. That is amazing to me. That's like saying, like, my dad's business, my dad pays payroll taxes just to be able to pay the people on his staff. And then when you get that pay from him, you also pay an income tax. So the government gets paid twice. That would be like saying the government is the victim in that relationship.
Yep. And we know the government ain't nobody's victim, buddy.
Right. And so how about the FBI, man? I feel stupid for tweeting this today because that's not going to do me any good. But good Lord, was this an inept, overzealous, corny FBI investigation?
Oh, Lord, yes.
Just terrible. Like, the FBI came in completely unprepared for what it was that they were trying to pursue. They had an idea of what the crimes would be and would look like. And when they found their patsy to carry out the elements of the investigation that they would need in order to bust a whole bunch of people, the person that they found, Christian Dawkins, repeatedly tried to tell them, none of the things that you're angling for make any sense. And so then at some point, Christian Dawkins, in an attempt to protect the FBI from themselves, not knowing that they were the FBI, starts keeping the money so that the FBI can recoup their investment in his business. He's trying to be financially responsible on the part of the FBI. That's how stupid that they were being. And we don't know because the FBI didn't participate in the documentary and won't produce any records. The guy that was the undercover agent that they were running everything through, his main investor, probably stole some of that cash.
Yes.
And got fired and or prosecuted.
I'm like, what are you doing? Like, Christian Dawkins is on tape saying, this is a bad idea. This doesn't make sense. Why are you trying to do this? The coaches don't want to meet you. They don't want to see you. This is not a good business model. Coaches are making millions. Giving them an extra $5,000 or $10,000, that's stupid. Like, they're not going to take it, and they don't want it. And, like, the FBI tried to invent a crime. It's almost like bad detectives. What do they say bad detectives and bad investigators do? They come up with the resolution first and then try to find their way back to the clues. But in investigation work, you are supposed to let the clues and the evidence take you to the solution instead of the other way around. And they came up with the solution first and then wanted to backtrack to the problem. What? It's insane, Ralph. And you are right. The FBI look like assholes. They look like idiots. And the fact that the FBI has participated so freely in the McMillions thing, because they look great and they did the great job.
Yes. So
they clearly participate in it.
Yeah. Great point. Great point. They were super enthusiastic to co-star in HBO's McMillions that came out about a month and a half ago, but they declined to participate in HBO's The Scheme, which comes out today. And that just goes to show you, I think, probably how they think of the way that they conducted this investigation, because they refuse the subpoenas, so they don't end up testifying in court. They never reveal what happens to, was it D'Angelo, the original undercover agent?
Yeah.
Who was supposedly the nightclub owner and investor. They end up spending an ungodly amount of money of taxpayer funds in order to trick Christian Dawkins into participating in this scheme. Ultimately, to have Christian Dawkins go throw that money at strippers in Vegas.
Like, and then he was like, I don't have any. I can't give it to the coaches. So guess what? I'll just spend it then. Fine.
And then Christian Dawkins hoards the cash in his own house.
And then uses
it to pay his lawyers to defend him from the FBI case.
And some of the money he actually put back into the business. Yeah. I'm just like, this is a stand-up guy. Like, I would do, after all of this, so Christian Dawkins first had the problem with the Uber thing, which made sense too. And I'm sitting here like, after watching everything, after his 18-month prison sentence, all of this, I'm looking at this and I'm like, I would clearly do business with Christian Dawkins. Clearly. Wouldn't think twice about it. Like, this dude is like Doogie Howser. Smart, yeah. Intelligent, well, like...
Has your best interest in mind?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, dude, that's why during the trial, he was going to go meet with Atlantic Records, and they gave him his own... He's going through a wire fraud. So he got sentenced in... So he actually had two trials. He got sentenced to 12 months in one and 6 months in the other one for conspiracy to commit wire fraud. What are we talking about here? But what did you think about the one thing that Pat talked about in the interview, which was interesting, is that Christian didn't snitch on anybody.
No.
He didn't snitch on anybody. Like, yes, there was wiretaps, so he couldn't deny that. And the one person that got fired out of this whole thing was Rick Pitino. But that was a combination of strippers and
that was a genuine lack of institutional control. Like, he had absolutely no handle on what was going on. He barely ever has a handle on what's going on in his personal life. Like, that was just, that was time was up for him, really. Yeah.
So what did, and Christian Dawkins said that Rick Pitino did not know, didn't anything. Like, he, and I was like, this dude's a stand-up guy. He's not, he refused to snitch. He just took his medicine.
Yeah. So not only did he take his medicine, like, he laughed about the fact that he got lied on by Sean Miller and to a much more serious extent, Will Wade.
They said they didn't even know the dude. Didn't even have any interactions with him. You're on tape stealing boxes, bro.
Yeah, and didn't get fired on their day off. So, like, I don't know, man. I he came away a very sympathetic figure. But then by the end, you don't really have a lot of sympathy for Christian Dawkins because you realize, like, he doesn't need it. He's a go-getter.
Yeah, he doesn't need it.
He's going to be just fine.
Yeah. That's a good point there, because a lot of times when you watch these documentaries and see stuff like this happen, people's lives are usually ruined. He had lived the life of a 60-year-old successful business person by the time he was 22.
Right. And I've investigated the AAU basketball scene, paying players, shoe companies hanging around. I've written stuff that has, you know, I wrote an article that broke up Marvin Bagley and DeAndre Ayton, the number one and number two pick in the 2018 NBA draft. So I've been in this world. If somebody came to me with what Christian Dawkins was doing, not what the FBI made him do, but if somebody came to me with just what Christian Dawkins was doing in that moment, I wouldn't have even blinked.
It's still going on.
Oh, absolutely. And it's going on in football. This is the funniest thing, is the dude that ends up serving no jail time, Marty Blazer, ends up admitting in open court that for 14 years he paid football players at like seven different schools, including Notre Dame and University of Michigan and Northwestern and Pitt. Right? So he came out and he said, like, oh, I've been doing this in football. Yet that fell on deaf ears, and no head coaches end up having to testify in this trial. Book Richardson goes to jail, and Sean Miller just gets to act like he didn't know the dude that he hung out with for 10 years. And at the end of the day,
he was just a low-level campaign guy.
Right. And then at the end of the day, the Southern District of New York, they come out and they have this press conference that says, like, we have your playbook. Like, they're going to come out and they're going to break up all of college basketball and change things forever. I am telling you right now, those people that work for the Southern District of New York in their district attorney's office that prosecute cases, they deserve nothing less than the absolute cruelest of scorn and laughter every single time they walk down the hallways of their own office. Like the way that people used to bully kids who definitely didn't deserve it in elementary school, you know, call them fatty, send them home crying, kick dirt in their eye, like that level of bullying. The coworkers of these people at the Southern District of New York that handled this case, or the people who didn't handle this case, should all be mocking and laughing at every single person who did every time they're around, because that's how embarrassing this documentary is for them when they play back that press conference. It's like a George W. Bush mission accomplished thing.
Oh,
like
yeah.
You should never be able to live that down, to come out, have a press conference and make it sound like you're going to change college basketball forever. And in the end, the only person that ends up doing any real time is the person that repeatedly tried to talk you out of this investigation, because even though he didn't know it was an investigation, he thought your plans were stupid. That's the guy that you end up nailing on behalf of the FBI's botched investigation, in which the person that was heading it up probably ended up possibly doing jail time himself. I hope the internet finds that guy. Really do, because he deserves to be laughed at as well.
What did you think about, because I asked him about the fact that, okay, so Jim Gatto and Merrill Code, who were at Adidas, they ended up getting 9 months and 6 months as a part of this. But I said, okay, Michael Avenatti and Nike didn't come up really. Well, not really. They just didn't come up, because Michael Avenatti tried to blackmail or extort Nike out of money.
Yeah.
Nike was brought up with their, you know, with their AAU system program, because Adidas has the grassroots, and then Nike has the EYBL.
Yeah.
And so I asked him, and he was like, well, yeah, it's like in the Nike thing, like Nike in court and all this stuff. Well, everybody in court, they knew that they had been doing the same things that Adidas did, but it just, like, everything just got shut down. Like everything just got just kiboshed. It was almost like God came down and was like, no, you will not talk about this. You will not prosecute this. And everybody was just like, okay, cool. All right, bye. Well, somebody's got to pay to keep our conviction rates up. There you go, Christian Dawkins. There you go, Gatto. There you go, Merrill Code. It was crazy.
We got to get my guy Zach Zoskin on the podcast, because I've spent some time around some of these Adidas grassroots guys on the football side. Ryan Lacy, Zach Zoskin just left Adidas to actually like work in management for some athletes, and you know they're out at the camps that we have as part of Rivals. Like they're around these kids very young age, getting to know them, getting to know what they like, trying to convince them to wear Adidas, sending them shoes, doing all the stuff that is above board and legal. But like their whole job is to form relationships with high school kids so that that kid can then go to college where they're supposedly untouchable, but hopefully they're at a school that Adidas is pumping tens of millions of dollars into. And I think was it Dan Wetzel who said that, like, if somebody's paying you $160 million, they're your boss.
Yeah.
So then you got them in this incubator, right? And I know that, you know, one athlete that Adidas ended up signing was Christian Kirk, who was at an Adidas high school, went to Texas A&M, which I believe was sponsored by Adidas at the time. I could be wrong about that. But then he ended up signing with Adidas coming out of for the NFL draft. And so, you know, that stuff is not very surprising, especially when they formed a relationship with you from when you're very young. But it is a really weird system in which you become sort of untouchable, except for that apparel company is allowed to donate directly to the program while you're in it.
Yeah, and remember when the Pump Brothers, who I used to play for in high school, I think they were on Sports Illustrated, or Sports Illustrated is the 50 most powerful people in sports. And people were like, who are these two dudes? And they were, they've been in business and all this stuff for a long time, especially in the basketball AAU circuit. And then you have, and then they essentially would be steering kids to colleges. And then those colleges would then allow them, because they owned a ticket broker, like a resale company. So then their company would be allowed to buy almost like season tickets from the schools, and the March Madness tickets and the bowl game tickets, all of this stuff. They would get the primo seats, and then they would be able to sell them. So they would get an opportunity to buy them at face value, and then they can mark them up and sell them. So instead of taking huge payments, they would just from schools, they just wanted the ticket inventory. The way then they could then be able to buy it and then mark it up and sell it later.
Is it weird to you at all that UCLA has the by far highest apparel contract? Like, they even commented on what is Under Armour doing?
Dude, well, Under Armour wanted to be with a huge brand. And I mean, I don't know, because, dude, that's an extraordinarily big contract for a college. And, you know.
And UCLA still wasn't paying their bills.
No. And people don't even, and truthfully, it's kids that don't go to colleges, as we know, based upon shoe contracts. Based upon shoe contracts, because they don't want to wear certain shoes, so they won't go to certain schools.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look at this whole Puma thing, right? Like, first of all, the thing that he said about, like, doing all the legwork, and you could put $50,000 into a kid and they could turn around and sign with a mega agent who put no effort in that whole time, and that's just the risk that you run. That reminded me of DeAndre Ayton signing with Puma after going to a Nike school and having Nike sponsor his high school before he went to a Nike college. Then he ends up signing that shoe deal with Puma. Well, now DeAndre Ayton has missed like six different stints of games with ankle injuries. And there are kids out there who look at that and say, like, man, I would never wear that shoe. And so if Puma ends up getting a big time sponsorship deal with a big college at some point, you'll have kids say, like, I would never play at that college. And that's absurd, but that's how it goes. You know, it's really weird some of the things that factor into, you know, a kid making their decision. And you also have to realize every single one of these kids thinks they're going to the league. Every single one. And it takes getting to the college level to ultimately end up getting humbled. And then some kids don't end up getting humbled. They end up saying, like, oh, it's the coach. You know, like LeVar Ball always
hating on me. Yeah,
like,
the coach is hating on me.
It's never a you problem. You never have to take accountability for anything. And why would you be in a position to even take accountability when you have people paying your family because they believe that you could ultimately end up being a star? You have all these people treating you like a king, and the second you start to act like it, everyone's like, oh, what a diva. That's the way we're set up. We're pushing them in that direction.
Yeah, and I am, for one, not like, I hope that this sort of thing trickles over into the name, image, likeness stuff, and that this legislation gets passed, like meaningful legislation. So the kids, most of them young black kids coming from disadvantageous socioeconomic situations where they can get what is due to them. And truthfully, I just always look at it like, you should be able to participate when you are in revenue generation.
Yeah.
And the other part that is most important, that I think is most crucial in the situation, is everybody has a point in time in their life that they have the highest earning potential, when they are the most popular, when they can capitalize on these things. Sometimes that's when you're Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone. Sometimes it's when you're 60 years old, you have a windfall. You know, you don't know when it's going to be. And sometimes that time for people is in college. Like, imagine how much money Sabrina Ionescu could have made, or Remy Martin at ASU, or, you know, sometimes the volleyball or the girl that we talked about at Oregon, the assault.
Or God dang, if we knew about LeVar Ball when he was at Washington State, I mean, give that man his own show back then.
Yep. So I hope that it trickles all down into that. Do you have anything else on the scheme besides telling people to watch it?
Oh, please watch it. Please. It's funny. It pulls at your heartstrings, things that you wouldn't expect, right? Like there are it'll piss you off a little bit too, which is I think what any good documentary does. And this is obviously a very single-sided documentary that is presented from the only perspective that was really truly available. But the nice thing about it is with so many things on the record, everything is corroborated. So you're actually able to trust the point of view and trust the source that this whole thing is driven through. And I would say that to a lot of the Pac-12 fans out there that have felt like your program was embarrassed or you lost any sort of respect for any coach or assistant on your staff, I would say watch this, realize how widespread it is, and realize that guys like Tony Bland and Book Richardson really, at the end of the day, didn't do anything illegal. And the government had to invent ways in which to bend the law in order to put them in a situation where their actions were illegal. And so, you know, that there are still rules being broken, and whatever your moral assignment is that you assign to people based on those rules being broken, that's on you. And I understand it if just the rivalry is playing into it, right? Like ASU fans absolutely love that the cloud just sort of floats above, you know, Arizona. When's that other shoe going to drop? You know, when's Sean Miller getting fired? They enjoy that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, these are not questions of morality, in my opinion, and they should never have been questions of legality. And I'm somebody who's on the other side of this who believes that players should be paid anyway. So when I read Robin Hood, I understand Robin Hood to be the protagonist of Robin Hood, right? Yep. Like and I do trend more conservatively politically. I've still never reached a point in my life where I read Robin Hood and say like, oh, thief, put him in jail, right? You understand the conditions at the time and the context at the time. And the story of America is one of the people getting together and saying, hey, no taxation without representation, and rebelling. And when I see college basketball, I see a story that should be moving in that direction. And there should be some revolution in there to make sure that people are all getting theirs, because I think that's a very American thing. And so, you know, for the people that did get punished legally in this whole deal, I believe that I think they were handed a raw deal, and I don't have any ill will or ill feelings toward anybody involved in any of this. I think that the fault lies with the FBI and the Southern District of New York and Marty Blazer sucks.
Yeah, I totally agree. Thank you guys for listening to the Pac-12 Apostles. We appreciate your time, appreciate your energy. Send us your comments in. We already got one in about somebody saying, how could I defend a deadbeat like Christian Dawkins? We will talk about that. Send it in to imad@unafraidshow.com or hit me and Ralph up on Twitter. We're going to live tweet during the documentary airing, so it should be fun. Make sure you hit us up. Peace out. Catch you guys later. So-